What are the neural systems that constitute the essence of who we are? And when those systems fall apart, when memory fades or motivation dissipates, what becomes of personal identity? Neurological disorders force us to confront these questions directly. Today, we speak to Masood Hussain, Professor of Neurology and Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Oxford. Across his distinguished career, he has combined clinical practice with pioneering research to elucidate the neural foundations of thought, memory, and behavior. His recent book, Our Brains, Ourselves, was the 2025 winner of the Royal Society Trivedi Science Book Prize. It tells the stories of seven extraordinary patients and explores what their conditions can teach us about motivation, language, and perception, but ultimately about the fragile but resilient sense of selfhood. It is a compelling and widely celebrated work, and one we strongly encourage you to read. In our conversation, we explore the book's central ideas and their wider implications. We discuss its making, the science and philosophy at its heart, and the individuals whose lives illuminate what it means to have, and at times to lose, a sense of self. My name is Ivan, and this is Cortex Cast. Masood, you spent your early childhood in a country that was at that time called East Pakistan. Now this is Bangladesh. This is where you were born, where you grew up. But then later, together with your family, you moved to the UK, where you also attended school. Could you tell us how this experience of migration, of crossing cultures, shaped you as a person? What was this experience like?
Oh, it was completely bewildering, Ivan. As a six-year-old in the late 1960s, it seemed like a completely alien world. Lots of good things, but also very difficult because, we were conspicuously unusual, different. So I knew that I was a foreigner living in this huge cosmopolitan city, London, sometimes not very welcome foreigner, I've got to say, overtly unwelcome. But we also realised there were great things about being in London at that time, one of which was education. So that was a real primary driver for my parents making sure that we engaged with the schools and the community. After a few years, we moved to Birmingham, and that turned out to be even more kind of formative for my education and what I became interested in. But it wasn't always easy, although I've got to say there was a huge variation in terms of how people responded to foreigners at that time, just as there is now.
Yes, that's very true. And so, speaking of your education, at what point during its course did you first become interested in the human brain? I mean, was there perhaps a favourite subject at school or an encounter with literature or some other experience that first made you feel this vocation for neurology, for neuroscience? When did this first happen?
I love biology, and like most people, I think if you have a great teacher in a subject that you really enjoy, that stimulates everybody's interest. So for me, I was absolutely hooked on biology, and I thought one way in which I could apply biology usefully was to do medicine. And I got a place here at Oxford, at New College, where I'm still attached to nowadays, and it turned out to be fantastic because the undergraduate course in medicine here is really challenging you to think about biology, challenging you to think about why we believe in certain hypotheses. And the tutorial system turned out to be fantastic. We only encountered brains in the second year, but that was it. I was absolutely hooked because it became clear to me that we knew so much about the physiology and anatomy of other organ systems. We knew something about the way that nerves worked and that they were connected and the anatomy, but we really didn't have a very good idea of how that all mapped on to behavior. And that really was what I got interested in, is how does the brain create behavior? How is that happening? And more, you know, latterly, I've got interested in how does that go wrong? How does the dysfunctional brain lead to problems with abnormal behavior?
Yes, that's very fascinating. And indeed, as you say, it's surprising how little we actually know about the human brain. And in many ways, this is what elicits my interest for the subject. But you, of course, pursued this passion much further on, ultimately becoming both a practicing neurologist, a clinician, and also a researcher, a scientist. So could you tell us, how did these two, well, quite different strands of your life fit together? I mean, how have they informed each other over the years? And what do you gain from living in both worlds?
Well, I think if anyone had said to me at, you know, in my 20s that this is what you're going to do, I'd have said, fantastic. I'm going to grab this with two hands. It's turned out to be increasingly difficult to pursue a research and a clinical career because, you know, the way that things have developed is then it's become very hard to go through the hoops. Just going through the hoops is hard enough that it consumes most of your time. And I've discussed some of this in some editorials in Brain, which I edit, that the institutional bureaucratic systems, which have evolved ostensibly really to protect us, are also having this really detrimental effect. And I fear that it's actually very difficult for someone else to pursue this twin track, to be able to do research and run a clinical career is now like doing two jobs simultaneously, whereas before you could integrate these and still come out sane, or sort of sane. It's now become very, very difficult. So I'm very lucky because I managed to start that at a time when it wasn't so difficult to do that. I mean, obviously, it was still challenging. But I'm also lucky because the research I do is often on the patients I see. And that means that those two things are very, very strongly connected.
Yes, and this is quite amazing, really, because, of course, now your career has gained yet another dimension. You have become an author. And so at what point did you realize that, okay, the time is ripe, instead of publishing another research article in a journal, you should instead write something for a broader audience? I mean, why did you think that a book for the public would be the best vehicle for the thoughts that you must have been developing over all the years working closely with patients?
I think it probably goes back to childhood, because at the age of 10, my father brought a reel-to-reel tape recorder, one of those old-fashioned tape recorders you see in movies nowadays. And I thought, this is the perfect opportunity to dictate my novel, because I was absolutely assured that that's how you could write your novel. You just speak into the microphone and that would dictate your novel. Of course, I found it was much harder than I thought. You couldn't do that. But something in me from that time thought, I want to write. I want to be good at creative writing. And that was all left behind for 50 years or so. But more recently, I've gone back to thinking that I want to be a little bit more liberated in my writing, because one of the things about academic writing is obviously we're constrained by conventions. This is how you write a paper. And you'll have been told by lots of people about how one should write a paper. Whereas if you're writing a book, you're actually free to do what you want. Now, maybe that nobody really enjoys it. And that's always a risk. You're writing something that someone else isn't really going to be interested in. So I got back to this just before the pandemic started. I started thinking, okay, what would I write about? How could I put this down? How could it be engaging? How would it fill a vacuum that is there? And there are lots of books on patients with brain disorders. Mm-hmm. You know, famously, of course, Oliver Sacks. But what I thought was there aren't lots of books which tell the human story, engage the reader on how a clinician tries to make a diagnosis, really close up. How does somebody come to a diagnosis? Because you know, people don't come with predefined diagnoses. And also explain the neuroscience, because I think the neuroscience has moved on so much, for example, since the time of Sacks. We know so much more in so many ways. And although our treatments are relatively rudimentary, they are based on that neuroscience, and they can have a major impact on patients' lives. So I wanted to do that. And I also wanted to set the book in this moment, at this time, so that if anyone was to read this at a later date, they would think, oh, this is how they used to do it. You know, this is how clinicians used to think. How quaint, but also make it clear what the atmosphere was like, what the time was like in terms of how people did things. And I've set it in London, where I was working at the National Hospital for Neurology and UCL, because it gives a place and a time, including the fact that there is a sub-theme in this book, which is that many of the patients who have these disorders not only have a change in their selves, but a change in their social selves, which makes a difference to how they belong to society. So I wanted to explore all of those themes and still make it engaging. So it was challenging.
Of course, it is a really demanding endeavor, especially when you are trying to unravel really complex topics such as self and identity. And, you know, there is this whole relationship between personal identity and social identity, and you have spoken about this already. And of course, we'll dive into this much more deeply later on. But it is the way in which you present this in the context of the patient's stories. And actually, I must say that at times it felt as though this could have even been a fictional novel, right? So you really do connect with the patients and their stories. You really do feel the emotions. And all of that makes this an absolutely fantastic book. You know, it's a real tour de force, I will even say. So once again, I strongly recommend our listeners to have a read. But anyway, at this stage, I do think it's worth also asking, how were you able to strike a balance between scientific rigor and clarity? So carefully explaining the, well, quite complicated neurobiology behind the patient's disorders in a way that is accessible to a broad audience, while also not losing the technical accuracy.
It's not always easy. And I didn't get it right first time necessarily in all the things that I wrote about. But I wanted it to be something that someone with no scientific training could read and at least grasp the essential parts of. Because I think when you're talking about neurological diseases, including neurodegenerative diseases, people understand that there's some kind of thing going wrong with the brain, but they have very little idea of what that would entail. What does it actually mean? Even at the level of what we might call systems level, what is going wrong? Is it memory? Is it language? Is it attention? And usually patients just think of it as memory, but actually there are many different aspects of brain that can be dysfunctional and lead to people presenting to us. And then if you were to take it to the molecular level, that's an even bigger step for most people to make. So I wanted to be able to tell that story in a relatively light way without losing the fidelity of what's happening. I don't want to make something up which distorts the facts, which is tempting in some ways, because if you simplify too much, you do that. But I also didn't want to overcomplicate it. So you have to tread this middle ground. And I think if you're used to teaching, one thing you do gain from that experience is how to communicate something in a way that people will get, at least the first bit, and then you can elaborate a little bit further. So that was definitely one aspect. But I also thought the mechanism of telling the story would actually keep people interested and engaged, because they'd want to know what was going to happen next. And that's really important in writing, is to, you know, hook people into thinking, I want to know what's going to happen to this person. But if you're also going to tell me what the science is, okay, I'm interested in that too. So I wanted to do that. And I guess the final bit is there is actually an awful lot of me in there. Mm. And it's, I felt that making it personal, making it sound like there is me being frustrated, there's me also being surprised. These are things that happen to a clinician, and we shouldn't shy away from showing that humanity in a book, because these are parts of what happens to us when we're meeting people. You know, we're not always empathetic. Mm. We're always sometimes we're frustrated, but I wanted to show that human side too. So putting it together, I just thought I would just try and do this as naturally as possible. Tell the story, explain it as if you were communicating this, saying this to people who don't quite understand or have no prior knowledge.
Right, I see. And yes, definitely the small snippets from your own story really did bring the whole book to life. That was great. And what I also loved was the fact that the patient's stories were like sprinkled with all sorts of cultural, historical, and philosophical references. I mean, you even decided to open the book with a discussion of the French novelist Marcel Proust. I mean, could you tell us a little bit more about why you decided to do this? How are you able to incorporate these stories without derailing from the main narrative, from the main plot? And also how it is that a discussion of historical figures who suffered from neurological disorders exemplifies the main theme of the book, and how it also illuminates modern neurology in general.
Yeah, and I think I felt that I needed the confidence to be able to do that, because you could easily say this is very digressive. Mm. And I think what I realized in reading other authors is that it's actually all right to be digressive, so long as your digression has some kind of relevance to the story you're telling, and that you don't just go off on a tangent which doesn't seem to be at all attached to the main theme of the story. So I kind of developed that confidence. I thought, okay, I can talk about various aspects of historical interest here that might be related. One of the chapters is about someone who's losing their concepts and their lexicon, the words they have and what they mean. So I didn't think that it was inappropriate then to talk about how dictionaries were once formulated, mm-hmm. and how people who have started off producing dictionaries had the same problem. If I give you a word, how do I define it? Mm-hmm. Well, often I'm also going to define it by showing you examples of how it's used, the concept behind that word. And this is exactly what was being degraded in this patient who actually had a condition called semantic dementia. Mm-hmm. His mental lexicon and his representation of concepts was slowly being degraded. So I think it was a good way to try and explain to somebody that we don't keep a dictionary in our heads, but we do keep concepts in our heads, right, and how that might be degraded. So, yeah, I think you have to have the confidence to be able to do it. And I learned that, yeah, I could have a go at this, and provided people were still interested, they would stick to the book. And so the book is really about how different modules or functions in the brain create this society of mind which we call the self. And I had written much of the book, but I realized that the beginning needed something to draw the reader in. And I was trying to think of a famous person who would be a good example about how people might be frightened of their self changing with a neurological disease. It turns out that Marcel Proust, a great literary figure, was someone who was absolutely scared about the possibility that he was going to have a stroke. His mother had had one. She developed aphasia, a disorder of language. His father died also of a stroke. He was convinced he was going to have a stroke. And he was so worried that he decided to go and knock on the door of Babinski, famous neurologist of the time, who actually lived 10 minutes down the road from where he was. Because Proust, in his conviction that he was going to have a stroke, decided that what he really needed to have was a burr hole, a hole drilled in his skull to release the pressure. Thankfully, Babinski decided that this was not necessary. He wasn't having a stroke and sent him away, but he still was convinced that he was going to have a stroke. And the reason he was worried was that he'd seen his mother lose the power of speech and communication. And for Proust, language was absolutely paramount, not only in his writing, but also the fact that he had connected with French society and was such an influential figure. And that was difficult because, you know, he's half Jewish. He's not your establishment French aristocrat. And yet he'd managed to infiltrate those strata of society. And so he, if he had lost his language, if he'd had a stroke, it would have been catastrophic for him in many ways. So I actually describe this situation because I thought it's a good way to explain that of all the things that we're most worried about, it's developing a neurological disorder. And Proust kind of encapsulated this problem in many ways. He was so, so concerned about it. So that's why I used him. Of course, there have been, you know, many other people who have developed neurological disorders who are famous individuals. But he exemplified the fact that he had this fear of developing one, even though he never really developed a neurological disorder. And the fear that I think many of us had, if we've seen people with neurological disorders, whether it's a dementia or Parkinson's disease or whatever it is that we change. We are no longer the person we used to be. And that's what the book explores, is what creates a self and how does a self change? And what does it mean? Well, it means that your identity changes in some way, and that's your personal identity, the way you see yourself but others see you. But it also means that your social identity changes, and something that perhaps as scientists we don't think enough about unless we're social psychologists, that actually a change in the self is so critical to how you connect with other people. You know, you might think, okay, if someone has a problem with their visual perception, they've got a problem with their visual perception, but actually that problem will have a knock-on effect on how they interact with people and how the people around them, their friends and family, interact with them. So that was one thing I really wanted to explore, is how these different brain functions, which create our society of mind, and are critical for our sense of self, how they're also very important for placing us in society and making us feel that we belong. Because many of these people, when they develop a neurological disorder, start to feel that they don't belong.
Right, right. Yes, this is very true, because your patients really do undergo quite remarkable transformations. And what really is striking is that a small disruption, even in a single component of what is otherwise, well, quite a complex system, right, can have dramatic effects. So, for example, one of your patients presents with a severe lack of motivation, with apathy, and you describe to us the neural circuits involved in generating this sensation of being motivated. And again, it is sufficient for just one of those parts of the circuit to go wrong for there to be a deficiency in a single neurotransmitter, or for there to be one single lesion, for there to be, you know, far-reaching implications on the patient's everyday life. And so from a neurologist's perspective, from a doctor's perspective, how do you, first of all, go about identifying that exact component, where it is that there has been a failure? And secondly, how do you also distinguish everyday fluctuations in motivation, which admittedly we all experience, from something like this, from something that is truly pathological? So how does this process of diagnosis work?
I think the most important thing is to listen. So you have to take the history really well. And one of the things that, you know, is really essential in for medical students, for example, to get is this isn't a perfunctory exercise. You have to listen and follow the clues in the conversation. So one thing that often happens is apathy. Pathological apathy is misdiagnosed as depression. People think that you're not motivated because actually you're low in mood. And that's what's the reason. And of course, if you're depressed, you can lose your motivation. But you can also try to find out from the patient, see whether they actually have low mood. The patient in the book we're talking about is a young man who actually didn't have any problems with his mood. He was quite happy, even though he'd been fired from his job because he wasn't motivated enough to do his work. He didn't see a problem about it. He was happy about the future. He didn't see any issues about not going to get unemployment benefit. He didn't have a problem with living with his friends who'd kindly offered to take him in, but quite soon decided that was a mistake because he did nothing around the house. So to answer your question, it's really important to take the history carefully. Now, if you think there is a neurological process causing this, one of the things that we might then go on to do is to actually scan the brain. But obviously, you can't do that on everybody who is lacking a bit of motivation one day. And in this case, he happened to have two critical strokes, tiny little strokes, affecting the basal ganglia, and that was what was causing the problem. Mm-hmm. But before I'd met this person, I hadn't really thought that there is a biological system which is involved in motivation in you and me. Meeting him made me go and read the literature, the animal literature, on motivation. And to my surprise, you know, there's a 30-year history of people who've looked at this and identified brain regions that include the basal ganglia in terms of linking motivation signals to action. So this guy was actually not motivated because he wasn't incentivized by anything to do any action. So he'd sit around all day doing nothing. Nothing was rewarding. And the lovely thing about this patient is that we were actually able to do something, because the evidence suggested that dopamine is a critical neurotransmitter in motivation. We first used levodopa, the drug that was originally used for Parkinson's disease. That didn't do very much, but when we used a dopamine receptor agonist, as we slowly increased the dose, we were actually able to restore his motivation. So this man who was unemployed, really dependent on his friends, did nothing all day, came back to see us a few months later. He had a job. He'd become very disheveled beforehand. Now he was very spruced up. And what was most remarkable, he had a girlfriend. Before, he wasn't meeting anybody. So that really was a lesson for me in thinking you could extinguish motivation with these critical lesions, but you could restore it also with a dopaminergic drug. Mm-hmm. And although he is rare, it turns out that pathological apathy is a very common problem across many neurological disorders. And our hypothesis is that's because the same circuit is being nibbled away at by different types of pathologies. And that's how you can get many different pathologies, Alzheimer's, vascular, Parkinson's, in some patients leading to the same phenotype, apathy. So it turned out to be an amazing lesson that this circuitry is so critical for motivation, and that we can modulate it. We can treat people with disorders of this circuitry.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it is reassuring to know that there is at least sometimes treatment available out there, despite the complexity in the etiology of these conditions, as you have described. But yeah, just speaking more about dopaminergic systems, there is also a patient in the book with suspected Parkinson's disease. So could you firstly briefly recount their story and also tell us why it is so crucial to study these systems, not only for therapeutic applications, for understanding and treating these disorders, but also in the broader sense for exploring this idea of selfhood, which is so central to the book?
Well, he turned out to be complicated because he had Parkinsonism, so some of the motor features of Parkinson's disease, but he also was experiencing visual hallucinations. That's what sort of brought him to us. He was seeing people in the night, and that's what really frightened him and brought him to us. He turned out to have something called Lewy body disease, which is actually a type of a continuum of Parkinson's disease in many ways. And we were actually able to treat his visual hallucinations using not a dopaminergic drug, but a cholinergic drug, because it turns out, you know, although textbooks often say that Parkinson's disease is dopaminergic, it turns out that neurodegeneration is far more widespread in Parkinson's disease. Mm. It also includes the cholinergic system. And that might be very important, not only for visual perception, but also for cognition in Parkinson's disease and Lewy body disease. So it's through taking the history and the examination. In this case, he admitted that he was having visual hallucinations. He wasn't very happy about admitting that because his job was at risk from telling us. And on examination, he had mild features of Parkinsonism. These two features together give you a most likely diagnosis of Lewy body disease. And that's what led to the investigations and the treatment. But again, going back to your question a little while earlier, it's the history that matters. And there aren't many conditions which give you visual hallucinations like this, where there are no auditory hallucinations. And often the people or animals, which are shadowy figures. And when you see Parkinsonism with it, there aren't many other possibilities in the diagnosis.
So things are, as always, very complicated. There are many different chemical compounds involved, many different neurotransmitters, dopamine, acetylcholine, and so on. But then, of course, as you say, there are other classes of molecules implicated here. So you mentioned Lewy bodies. Could you briefly explain to our listeners what exactly they are and what their role is in the pathophysiology of Parkinson's disease? And interestingly, many similar molecular events underpin the progression of several other disorders of the brain. So, I mean, why might you suppose this is the case? Why might it be that misfolded protein aggregation, what is called proteinopathy, is such a recurring theme?
You're right. I mean, the convention nowadays is to consider that many neurodegenerative diseases are really due to aggregation of misfolded proteins. And they can range from Parkinson's disease and Lewy body disease, which has alpha-synuclein as a constituent of those Lewy bodies, which are found in both Parkinson's disease and Lewy body disease. They can include amyloid and tau in Alzheimer's disease, but they can include rarer proteins in other types of neurodegenerative diseases, like frontotemporal dementia, for example. So a theme that's emerged is, if you look under the microscope, you can find these aggregations. Sometimes those aggregations lead to these bodies that are visible under the microscope. And the view that's emerged is that somehow these misfolded proteins are toxic. They either are toxic to the neurons directly in terms of synaptic transmission, or they trigger some kind of cascade of events, which means that the neurons are under attack and they degenerate, and that leads to brain atrophy. Now, for some people, this is too much of a simplification, that actually perhaps these protein aggregations are really a kind of epiphenomenon. Something that you're seeing is a result of the pathophysiology. On the other hand, others would argue, well, if they're just an epiphenomenon, why is it that some people with genetic disorders, for example, that lead to accumulation of amyloid, will get Alzheimer's disease? So this is an interesting debate. And one possibility is that in, say, Alzheimer's disease, amyloid pulls a trigger maybe decades before someone actually develops dementia, a trigger which leads to a cascade of molecular changes, perhaps including inflammation in the brain, that leads to degeneration. Because what's happened is that when you try to clear amyloid, which can be done successfully with monoclonal antibodies, the effects have been really modest in terms of cognitive improvement. Why would that be if amyloid is a toxic species? Well, it may be that it did its damage 20 years ago in terms of pulling the trigger. And if you sweep it away now, you're going to get very minimal effects. So I think that's a very lively, interesting debate. And although there's a lot of evidence that protein aggregation is the key toxic event, we ought to be open-minded about other possibilities here.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, mechanistic detail, like what exactly is going on with the molecules, remains quite scarce, really, even now. But nevertheless, just to think about potential future perspectives, do you think there are any emerging and promising clinical strategies for treating these disorders apart from monoclonal antibodies, which are notoriously difficult to deliver into the brain?
Yeah. So I wonder sometimes whether we are being too aspirational, thinking that we will cure a neurodegenerative disease. Symptomatic treatment, if we could improve some of the symptoms to a point which is much better than we can do now, that would still be an important goal. So pharmaceutical companies have spent billions trying to get the cure. I wonder whether that's absolutely realistic. Mm. So whether more modest aims in terms of improving symptoms and the day-to-day lives, the quality of life, not only of the patient, but of the poor people who look after them, is a better ambition. Of course, it doesn't sound sexy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to improve you a little bit, but it's not going to be a cure. But if we could, it would make a huge difference. So I think we've just got to keep that in mind, that in these kinds of conditions, trying to go for a cure is really, really aspirational, and possibly something that may not be achieved in the next 10, 15, 20 years. And what would that cure look like when you've already lost function? Would that cure be simply stopping further neurodegeneration? I think that would be the best one could hope for. Or are you really thinking you can restore cognitive functions that have already been lost? Now that would be amazing to be able to consider that. So, of course, there could be symptomatic treatment with drugs, but, you know, things that were considered bizarre only 20 years ago, like deep brain stimulation or local infusion of, you know, some sort of neuromodulatory substance. These things are possible, and they make a difference. In Parkinson's disease, deep brain stimulation has made a huge difference to some people's lives. And that is not a cure.
Yes, that's true. It's not a cure, but I guess at least it's something. And, you know, realistically speaking, as you say, it's probably the direction in which we'll be heading, at least in the near future. So could we now talk about another important cognitive function that is impaired in some of your patients, namely memory? So with the illustration of two of the patient's stories, you make a distinction between different types of memory. So firstly, of course, long and short term, but also semantic and episodic. Could you walk us through these differences and also tell us how you approached the management and diagnosis in each case?
Yeah. So we have learned that memory is not one thing. And we've learned that essentially from patients like the ones we see in the book, because they reveal double dissociations. So you can have a problem with your long-term episodic memory, forgetting about things that have happened, episodes that have happened to you in life. That could be yesterday, it could be last week, but it could also be just 10 minutes ago. And that is what we would still call episodic memory. But you could be fine with your short-term memory. And psychologists and cognitive neuroscience refer to short-term memory as something that lasts about, let's say, 15 seconds, unless you keep on repeating it, rehearsing it. So, for example, if I give you a long telephone number to remember, that would be in your short-term memory. It would go out of your short-term memory very quickly, unless you keep on rehearsing it, replaying it. But those two systems have conventionally been considered to be associated with two different brain networks. Long-term episodic memory has been associated with the hippocampus, and initially, really, because of patients with hippocampal damage showing that they have this problem with episodic memory, but having intact short-term memory. Whereas short-term memory has been found to be disrupted by parietal or frontal lesions. But those patients, conversely, can have intact episodic memory. The other interesting part of memory, there are several aspects of memory, but the other interesting part of memory for me is semantic memory. And that is memory about concepts, the things that we slowly begin to learn through our lifetime. What's the capital of France? Who wrote Romeo and Juliet? These kinds of things are become embedded as knowledge. So if I was to ask you to talk about Shakespeare, you'd be able to tell me many different things about Shakespeare, and that would be embedded in your concept of Shakespeare. But it could be even more trivial, like table, the concept of table. We can identify different types of table, and we understand what a table is for. And even if I give you a table you've never seen before, you will be able to think, ah, oh, this is probably a table. So those concepts grow with us over time, and they seem to be dissociable from episodic long-term memory and also from short-term memory. And intriguingly, it's with patients who start to lose this semantic memory that we've found this dissociation. And in the book, there is a patient who starts to run out of words, but actually what he's running out of is concepts. In Gabriel García Márquez's book, you know, 100 Years of Solitude, he amazingly describes a community who are losing their memory, but they're not losing their episodic memory. They're losing their memory of words. They're forgetting what words mean. So one of them decides, okay, I'm just going to put labels. I'll put a label on the cow to say that's cow. I'll put a label on table to say it's table. But then he realizes that that isn't going to help, because the word doesn't tell him what a cow is and the table is. So this linkage between the deep meaning of something and the sort of superficial label we give to it, the name, is really fundamental about how we use words, you know, and the ability to use words in a flexible way to create an argument, to create new arguments, to create new sentences, concepts, depends on those fundamental ideas, those concepts that we have. And it turns out that that is localized in the left temporal pole, the language hemisphere for most of us, right at the sort of end of that language stream in the temporal pole. And if you get degeneration there, you get this problem called semantic dementia. You cannot dissect these things without listening to the patient, finding out what's wrong, and then assessing those different types of memory. And there are relatively simple ways to assess those different types of memory at the bedside or in the office. Yeah.
Right. Okay, I see. And so these functions that you speak about, memory, language, speech, all seem to be related in some way. And so I would imagine at least that disruptions in any of them, individually or collectively, would in any case have overlapping symptomology. So clinically, how do you go about deconvoluting this? How do you know which exact function is failing?
Yes. So it depends on when you see somebody. If you see somebody early on, as many of the patients are in this book, you can get the pure syndrome. But you're absolutely right. Obviously, these regions are interconnected. And although you might see a pure syndrome of semantic memory loss to begin with, as that neurodegeneration proceeds, it will have such a hit not only on that region, but also on the connections of that regions, that you will begin to see other problems manifesting. So I think it depends at what stage of the illness you see somebody. And you know, unfortunately, in many neurodegenerative diseases, it spreads.
Mm. Yes, that is quite fascinating. And as we speak about different regions of the brain working together, I think this brings us quite nicely to what is probably, again, the main theme of the book that you discuss in quite some detail, notably in the final chapter. And this is the idea of self and identity. So again, looking from a philosophical perspective, there are many theories surrounding this topic, and some of them propose that this is a sensation that emerges from the overall function of the brain, so many regions working together to generate this sensation. Some instead argue that no, this is localized to one place in the brain. Then, of course, we can also talk about the self having a physical basis or maybe a mental basis or both indeed. So could you tell us about your standpoint on this and also maybe how your patient stories helped you, at least for yourself, elucidate this?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, obviously, philosophers have been interested in the self for centuries. And it's easy for us not to think deeply about this because we think, you know, we are a bodily delimited self. Of course, I am myself, you are yourself, because you occupy this body, I occupy this one. But a few simple thought experiments have led philosophers to think it can't be that. It's not just the limits of the body that define who the self is. And these thought experiments are beautiful experiments where you might think, imagine that you could teleport somebody, yourself, to a different world, you know, like beam me up, Scotty, in Star Trek. If that was the case, would you still be the same self at the other end? And most of us might say, well, of course, yeah. You know, maybe it's the same kind of configuration of brain that's emerged at the other end. Then the next bit of the thought experiment would be, well, okay, let's see if we could duplicate you. We'll make one of you there on Mars and another one of you on Venus. Who is the true self? Right. And I think what that has led to is the idea that self cannot mean anything unless there's some kind of psychological continuity, some first person continuity with whoever it was before. The experiences that they've had have got to be something that have been carried over to this other self. So these are thought experiments. And obviously other philosophers have thought the self is an illusion. You're kidding yourself. You know, that's what Hume famously thought about. It's a bundle of perceptions. And for Locke, it's memory is really important in gluing your sense of self, because otherwise you don't have this continuity. You mentioned that some people, including neuroscientists, have been trying to localize the self, you know, with brain imaging. And as Dan Dennett, the philosopher who died sadly last year, said, there's no point in looking for the self like that in the brain. You're never going to find one region of the brain which is the self, because that isn't how the self works. The self is the totality of brain function. And I think I would subscribe to that. I think many neuroscientists would subscribe to that, that it's an emergent property of the brain. And as Marvin Minsky, who's one of the pioneers of AI, put it, it's a society of mind. So why is that society of mind interesting in terms of thinking about what patients can tell us? What we find is that society is disrupted by taking away one of the functions, language, perception, attention, memory, motivation, whatever it is, that society of mind is disrupted to create a different self, a different kind of personal identity. But I think it's also really important because it's telling us something about how ourselves are important in embedding us in society. That society of mind is crucial for how we are represented in society. You know, self doesn't mean very much unless you think about other. And for many of us, if you were to ask, who are you? We might say something a bit about our backgrounds. I might say, I'm someone born originally in Bangladesh. I grew up in Birmingham. I am a scientist. I'm a clinician. I have two children, whatever it is. But I'm going to talk a little bit about my affiliations, the kind of constellation of affiliations that I have in terms of the society around me. And many of the patients that we see in the clinic suddenly lose some of those connections, and they are not the same person in terms of their social network. So for me, the self is about personal identity, which is an emergent property of the brain, but it's critical to think about that with respect to social identity, how we belong within our society.
Yes, and I definitely agree with you, because the self is, well, such a complex and, you know, multifaceted, multipartite phenomenon that it does not make sense to simply reduce it to one single source, right? It is indeed the workings of many different regions of the brain together that gives rise to identity, both personal and then by extension social as well. Now, you also mentioned artificial intelligence. And now that we speak about emergent properties of networks of neurons, which in very simple terms is what the brain is, I cannot help but ask you, in this day and age, do you think it will ever be possible for this technology, for artificial intelligence, to develop some sort of identity or self, whatever that would mean?
I mean, in a way, in principle, why not? Right? And some of our colleagues and friends are already using large language models to chat to and getting advice from. Some people get therapy and they almost feel like they're talking to somebody. Now, obviously, large language models have their limitations in terms of what they're actually doing, processing. They don't have concepts in the way that we have. But you could imagine a day when they would. And not so long from now, you could imagine at least attributing some form of identity. Interestingly, philosophers have made a distinction between selves and persons. So a person is a rational being who can be held morally responsible for their actions, whereas you could imagine there's a minimal self, which might be a cat or a dog or an infant, who cannot be held morally responsible for their actions. So I do wonder whether you could imagine a world in which AI could be a minimal self of sorts.
Yes, that's a really interesting thought, and we will have to see how this all unfolds in the future. Time will tell, I guess. So just to close now, really, Masood, I'm going to ask you a few quick-fire questions, if that's all right, just to conclude. So firstly, which patient from the book kept you thinking about them for the longest, and why would that be?
I think the first patient, David, who is the patient who lost his motivation, has been absolutely critical in terms of my thinking, but also in terms of my research, because it led to 15 years worth of research.
Right, yes, of course, naturally. So the next question. If you could give one single recommendation to families facing a new diagnosis that threatens identity, what would that be?
It's hard because it's frightening, but I think what is important is knowledge, is understanding the condition. And so if there are ways in which you can get that knowledge, whether it's from professionals or from societies or from patient groups, it's worth getting that knowledge. Because if you live without the knowledge, you're more likely to be frightened about what you're seeing.
Yes, definitely. That's very important. And finally now, what single scientific question about identity and the brain keeps you awake at night?
Not sure much keeps me awake at night in that kind of way, but I suppose, have we got this right? It's very difficult thinking about ourselves. So that's the problem. And we are unique selves. We think of ourselves as very different from animals. There aren't many other species that we think of in the same way as having a sense of self. So have we actually got this right? And obviously, this is a question that's been troubling people for hundreds of years. Have we got a really good perspective on self and identity? I think we're in a better place than we used to be. We're certainly in a better place than thinking that the self is something outside the mind. I think there's really no reason to believe the self is anything other than something that emerges from the brain. So if I had to say, it would probably be just querying the possibility that we haven't got this right in terms of thinking about brains and cells.
Masood, it has been a real honour to host you, a real pleasure to talk to you. This was a very inspiring and interesting discussion, and we would like to thank you very much indeed for being with us here today.
Thank you, Ivan.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. Our conversation with Professor Hussain has given us glimpses into both the science and humanity of the brain, and how the study of neurological disorders challenges us to rethink how the brain creates who we are. Thank you for being with us. For more interviews and thought-provoking discussions, make sure to subscribe to Cortex Cast. And with that, it's farewell from me. All the best. Cheerio.